All right, we are waiting for Vanessa Van Edwards to call in. She's the lead investigator at Science of People. It's a human behavioral research lab, and her goal is to uncover the hidden side of people and teach you how to unleash your inner awesome with the best people hacks and science facts. It's my pleasure to welcome to this week's show Vanessa Van Edwards. Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I actually saw you online. I looked at your website, and because I'm really fascinated because the theme of my show is Get the Funk Out. Mm-hmm. So I was fascinated by, you know, the whole science of behavior and nonverbal communication, and you have so many of these really interesting videos and all this great info and research. So let me back up. What led you to study this? Why is this such a fascination with you?
Yeah, so, you know, I was one of those kids where I always had parents and adults and teachers telling me, you know, just smile, be yourself, make friends at camp. You gotta find your best friend, work with your partner. Mm. And I was always, those kinds of things for me were like saying, turn the sky green, just make your hair blonde, and I'm a brunette, so... Right. I had no idea what that meant. What was easier for me were book smarts, right? Like tests, taking essays, great. That had rules, that had structure,
yes.
It had formulas. And so I think that it became a fascination because it seemed to come naturally to everyone else, but it was not coming naturally to me. And that's sort of what started me on this career, that there had to be other people like me out there.
Well, what's interesting, too, I started thinking about my own behavior when I was younger, and I'm more of an observer. I wouldn't jump in, and I'm not an extrovert, and I would watch how people would express themselves and what reaction that would cause from the other person.
Yep, yes.
So you talk about that as far as dating and even career advice. I mean, there's a lot we can talk about, and I'm going to have you on again, but how do you... Tell me a little bit about body language and work.
Yeah, so what I didn't realize, and I am, so sadly, I'm less of an observer and more of a mindless talker. So when I get really nervous or anxious, I interrupt, I can't focus on what's being said, I just chatter, which is I think, worse than being an observer in a certain sense. And so what I didn't realize is I always thought that my first impression happened the moment I started talking.
Oh.
And so I focused a lot on what I was going to say to be impressive, what I was going to say to be funny, what I was going to say to sell myself, my elevator pitch. Those were, I thought that that's where I had to sort of put all of my effort. When actually the science is very clear that our first impression happens not the moment we start talking, but the moment someone first sees us.
Interesting.
And so... My first impression, what people decided about me, if they liked me, if they didn't like me, happened the moment I entered into a room, the moment I walked into the playground, the moment I walked into a negotiation boardroom or a pitch or a presentation. It was when I was passing out handouts and setting up the projector and shaking the coordinator's hand.
Right.
That was actually my first impression, not the opening line of my speech, my interview, my first answer.
Interesting.
And that realization was horrifying to me at first. But it also was like relief because it explained why I was having such a hard time. It explained why interviews hadn't gone well. It explained why I would pitch a client and get a no and have no idea why. It explained why I would walk into a networking event and not make any substantial contacts. What was happening was I was signaling off, and there's three different levels in a first impression. And so I think about every relationship can be broken down into three different parts. And these are also three different parts of my book. The first 5 minutes, the first 5 hours, and the first 5 days. So
okay.
In the first 5 minutes, there are three levels that someone has to pass through to level up with you, to level up to, I could spend 5 hours with this person.
Yeah.
And in a first impression, the things that are happening are, one, are you friend or foe? So are you trustworthy? Are you going to be safe for them? Second,
yes.
Are you a winner or a loser? And that's a terrible thing to think about, but what I'm saying is that, and this is research has been done that shows that we decide if someone has more pride nonverbal or defeated nonverbal, and we like to be around people who have pride nonverbal.
Okay.
And then lastly, are you an ally or an enemy? So is this person who could be on my team? Is this someone who would root for me? Is this someone who I like? Those are sort of the three levels that we're passing through, and that's all said with nonverbal signals.
That is so interesting. I makes me think back to like my first job interview or anything, or even dating. Oh, that was a nightmare.
I mean, when we talk about business, dating is the same way. You know, like when, so there's two different aspects on this is digital first impression, so your LinkedIn profile picture or your Tinder profile picture, your Match.com profile picture, and then your actual first impression, the moment you walk into a restaurant, the moment you go into a speed networking event or a speed dating event. Those are essentially the same. We're talking about the same science and the same principles, just slightly different modalities.
Okay. This is a personal question, but are you married?
I am married, yes. I've been married for 5 years.
Oh, that's wonderful. So when you were dating your husband, were you in the throes of all this research?
I was, yes. yes, I was. Actually, so it's funny. I was online dating for a while before I met my husband, and mm-hmm. I was doing a lot of sort of self-experimentation in the sense of, like, I would tweak something on my profile and see if I got more responses.
Right.
I would update a profile picture and see if I got better responses. I would change something. And so I was in that, he met me in the part of my career where I was doing a lot of like human guinea pig things, where I was mm-hmm. trying kind of radical things. And one of the things that I think really helped me find my husband was that when I first was dating, I was thinking about, and I know that you ask a lot of your guests about sort of a moment where you
yes.
got yourself out of something. So I was in like a very much a dating funk, so much so that I was on a boy diet, which is basically like, you know, okay, reset, reschedule.
Yes.
And so I took down all my profiles, kind of had a, you know, really good talk with myself and a couple of good friends. And what I realized is I had been trying to find as many fishes in the sea as I could. Mm-hmm. Like I was trying to appeal to as many people as I could. And what happens is it's the same with people pleasing.
Yes.
If you try to please everyone, you please no one.
Right.
And so I came across both on my profiles and in person as bland, a yes person, not very unique. And
yes.
I stumbled across a number of studies that found that being polarizing is actually a good thing because you immediately signal to people, I am your person.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd much rather have 5 people who go, whoa, this is my person, than 50 people who go, maybe.
Yes. No, I agree.
And so I started to put up in my profile pictures and in person more indicators that would be polarizing. And this is a very weird way to interact, but this is how I still interact to this day, where I immediately try to signal something that is my value or something about me. So my profiles, I would sort of state my deal breakers a little bit more openly. Like I would say, if you've never left, you know, I love traveling.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a passport, we probably wouldn't be a good match.
Right.
Like that's a very polar, that's not a lot of people, right? Like that,
yes.
that gets rid of a lot of people. And so I started using that more. And so I met my husband and he loved me for my weirdness. And that was 10 years ago. So
oh,
there
I
you
love
go.
It. But you know, that's interesting. When you stop trying to be maybe what you think you should be, I noticed I changed my Twitter picture from a beautiful headshot I had taken to a picture of me when I was 4 with a crooked smile and crooked pigtails and bangs I had cut.
Yes.
And more people yes. have followed me ever since.
Yes. Okay, so that is a perfect example of this. And I think that if I could issue one challenge, one kind of something to push you out of your comfort zone, because nothing
mm-hmm.
good happens in your comfort zone, would be to look at your profile and count how many polarizers you have, how many words or traits or asks are in there that you think people would go, whoa, that's not for me,
right.
or whoa, that's for me.
Mm-hmm.
You should have at least 3. If you don't have at least 3, your profile is not grabbing people. And I think that we should all have that. And that means that there are going to be people who immediately click off. But that's a good thing,
it
right?
Is.
Like, that's a good thing.
Yeah, because you need to find your people.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And my business is the same way. You know, on Science of People, when I first started writing, I was trying to sort of be a typical science journalist. I was trying to cover all the interesting people science that was out there in a very academic, neutral way. And what happened was, is I got some readers, but no one who really felt what I had been through, which was this awkward, horrible period of trying everything out myself. So when I started to write in a much more powerful voice and a much more unique voice, we definitely got unsubscribes, but our subscribes went up times eight. The amount of people who were like, yes, like, this is me. I'm a recovering awkward person. So
yes.
I changed the first line of my website to be, instead of learn the science of people,
yes,
okay, to I'm a recovering awkward person.
No, it's real, relatable.
Yeah, it's real. It's vulnerable, and it's hopefully more people go, yep, that's me.
That's what gravitated me to read more about you, because I thought, oh, I can relate to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that,
exactly.
That's really what matters. So you talked about being in a funk, and were there times when you were in a career funk? Like, were you ever unsure that this is what you wanted to do?
I was unsure that I could make money at it.
Mm-hmm.
I always knew that I would be obsessed with, you know, the self-help aisle at the bookstore is like Nirvana, you know, I love it there.
Yeah.
So I always knew that I'd be reading lots of self-help and probably writing about it, at least personally. I didn't know that there was going to be such a demand for it from a business perspective. I had, in my wildest dreams, maybe it was me and an assistant. And now we have over 127 trainers.
Whoa.
In 46 cities around the world. And I had no idea there was such a demand for teaching science-based people skills. And so that there was moments where I doubted that, but not my love of it.
You know, I want to tell you something. When I was in graduate school, I remember taking a class on qualitative research. It was one of my favorites. And we'd have to go into an elevator and face everybody. While everybody was facing the buttons, I'd have to stand there and stare at everybody staring at the buttons.
Yeah.
And I became an observer of people, less judgmental about someone might say, oh, that person was drunk. Well, maybe they have a personal problem, a health problem, or, you know, and just trying to be an observer before I judge. So what you have to offer is so powerful in the workplace.
Agreed. I think it actually is the differentiator between people who have a thriving career and people who have a kind of slow roll.
Yes. Because everybody wants to network and meet people and build relationships, but they're so awkward. And can you offer advice about, you know, making positive first impressions in different work situations?
Yeah. The first thing that I would say is there's this idea that I talk about called resource theory. And resource theory is a beautiful hypothesis about how people interact. And what these researchers argue, and I think this is in like it's in that latter half of my book. It's a little bit more advanced. Basically, what they argue is that everyone has six different resources, and we are constantly interacting, looking for more of those resources. So the resources are love, so like being accepted, belonging, service, so feeling supported or having people do for you,
okay.
Status, so praise, titles, public accolades, money, so being able to be financially stable, having enough to support your lifestyle, goods, so collecting things, gifts, having a big house, and then information, being in the know, advice, being wise.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they argue is, and I have found that this has been incredible in my own career, is that if you can figure out, A, what you are constantly looking for, and we all need all of these, right? It's not like we can survive without one, but we usually have a dominant one that we're constantly looking for, and it's usually the one that we didn't get a lot of in our childhood.
Okay.
So if we can think about what we are always searching for, that helps explain why we are happy in certain roles or with certain people and not.
Yes.
And then also what the people we're interacting with, what they're looking for. So a very specific example is I hired someone. She was really great. I really liked her work. And about 6 months, I was like, you know what? I'm going to make it work. I'm going to offer her a raise. And it was, you know, it was a big thing for our company. It was small at the time, and so I like moved around a lot of things and said, okay, I'm going to give you a raise. And she was not as excited as I thought.
Really?
About it. No, and I was like, wow, she almost was like, oh, okay, great, you know, I appreciate it, almost as if it was like a given or a step on the ladder. And I was like, oh my God, this is a huge give that she didn't even really appreciate. And I realized that her main resource language is status. So for her, what would have been way more influential was
a title.
A difference in title, yep, and listing her publicly on the website, Right. So she was writing articles but not using her byline. And that actually bothered her far more than any pay. But I had no idea. And so I realized that I've created these resource extraction questions of figuring out what someone's looking for. Once I realized that, I was like, oh, my gosh, I can add your byline. No problem. Like, we could add your picture to the website.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. She was like, you can add my picture? I was like, yeah, of course. Aww. We can add your picture. So, like, it was what I've realized is every single interaction is like this. You even find it, like, with mother-in-law or with friends, if they want to be in the know versus they want to feel like they belong, mm-hmm. versus they want to feel like you're doing for them. So they're very different ways of thinking about interacting. And in the workplace especially, that's how you get really loyal customers. That's how you get raises faster if that's your resource.
Yes.
Thinking about that is, I think, a much more powerful way to interact with people.
It's so interesting how people feel about being recognized, whether it's a certificate, an award, you know, a picture on a website. It's so fascinating to me.
Yeah, and it's not what you would expect. That's the problem, is most mm-hmm. managers, most employees, most bosses, most entrepreneurs, we think money, right? Financial mm. incentives, bonuses, raises, perks. But actually, that is not what motivates all of us. In fact, after a certain amount of money, it's usually not money anymore. So thinking about that incentivizing in different ways.
Right. Now, can you talk about social intelligence? How do you improve that, and what is that?
Yeah, so social intelligence is a pretty big concept. It's almost like asking someone, so tell me about chemistry. You know, what should we know about chemistry? And that I think is the biggest problem, is that our schools don't teach social intelligence like they teach chemistry.
Okay.
They don't teach social intelligence like we teach writing. You know, writing is a skill that you literally learn it for like 10 years in school, right? Like, we develop those skills over 10 years, and then we still keep honing them after we leave school. Social intelligence is the exact same way. However, we're not actually given practical practice or real techniques. We're sort of just thrown out into the playground and expected to make it work. I think when I was growing up, I had, you know, one class where it was instead of PE one day, they had us practice I feel when you, I want. I don't know if anyone's heard that famous phrase that teach kids. It's basically,
I think I have.
When you're upset about something, you say, I feel angry when you push me. I want you to stop pushing me.
Okay.
That was the only social skills training I got in, you know, 15 years of school. 15
oh my
years
gosh.
Of school.
And that is
most kids, right? Like,
yeah.
It's sort of an afterthought, or if someone's getting bullied or gets in a fight with a mean girl, there's just no formula for it. So I believe that social intelligence can be hacked and can be learned. I do believe that soft skills can be hard skills, and that is why I think that there is a programming language for humans. We have programming language for computers. I think it's the same thing for humans. With social intelligence, it's like, where to start? I think that and the first thing is that it can be learned, is that if you don't naturally have you don't feel that you naturally have charisma or leadership or influence, all of it can be learned.
Okay.
Science says that, as well as personal experience.
You know, I want to interrupt for 1 second. I feel like what you're trying to teach people could be used in any industry, even teachers, because I remember in high school, you know, working hard, and it was just, I felt like it was the teacher, because all of us were bombing, but she wasn't taking ownership into how she was connecting with us. Whereas mm-hmm. the teacher, where I would say, you know, I know I'm failing, but she was so enthusiastic and connected with me on a personal level, helped me get an A.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like you have so many different arenas that you connect with. You could even, you're already doing this, with teenagers.
Yeah, so that's the pro bono part of our business. So really corporate, you know, we do a ton of corporate trainings, and it is every industry. I mean, from dentists to oil drillers to salespeople to banks, we've done every corporate training you could possibly imagine. And then we try to speak in schools.
Mm-hmm.
We do usually a set of 3 talks, so it'll be teenagers and students. And we actually have done as young as 7-year-olds, because they need social skills,
yes.
if not more than teenagers. So we'll do a kid or teenager talk. We do a parent talk. So the parents will come in. We'll do the flip side of the teen talk, and then we do the teacher talk. So that's absolutely. Eventually, I would love to, because we have a curriculum for people skills that we teach, and it kind of just is adapted for any industry. So if I'm teaching the science of conversation, right, the framework, the roadmap of a sparkling conversation, mm-hmm. that can be used whether you're a teacher talking to a student or a banker talking to a client. So that's the kind of nice thing, is it's a very, very flexible science.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And because I think about when you start with kids, the way they communicate brings them into, you know, graduating, going to college, graduate school perhaps, or going into their first job. It all matters.
Yep. It matters, I think, even more than the technical skills. Or I like to say it's sort of like a lever. So can you have an amazing first impression and bomb an interview? Absolutely. But can you have a terrible first impression and ace an interview? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So you can have amazing technical skills, but you have to make sure that you set yourself up for success by knowing how to nail the first impression, also knowing how to build rapport. You know, you have these, most of my students, especially so we do corporate trainings as well as online courses. And I've found that for our online courses, the majority of our students are introverted male engineers, so like graphic mm-hmm. designers, programmers, very, very technically based. And they will say they're brilliant. They have these amazing careers. They've gone to MIT. They, you know, invented a robotics special thing, but they cannot interview, right? Like they cannot interview. They cannot negotiate for their salary. They can't work on a team. And so they end up getting fired, not getting hired, even though they have this amazing resume of technical skills, simply because they're missing a few people skills, and that kills me. Like, my entire mission in life is to not let that happen.
Plus, on a personal level, where are they with relationships? I mean, that probably doesn't work well either.
You know? Right. Yes, absolutely right. A lot of them will then take our dating elective because they're also not finding love, and they deserve it.
Mm-hmm. I watched a great video. You were being interviewed by two people. I'm not sure where it took place, but you were talking about body language, and there are so many different cues for, you know, when you cross your arms, obviously, where you direct your legs. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the basic thing you want to, it's hard to break it down in a little nugget, because the problem is when you break something, simplify it, people don't remember it. So.
Right.
The only thing that I would say is we are looking for winners and losers, and the universal body language of pride is taking up space, mm-hmm. rolling your shoulders back, head high, no blocking, so leaving your torso open, and defeat is the opposite. It's rolling your shoulders in, tucking your chin to your chest, taking up as little space as possible. We know this instinctively, but the problem is all of us, most of us, check a phone. Every single time that you check your phone, you are accidentally going into loser body language.
Yeah.
And so you have to be very careful in those first few minutes to not be hunched over a phone or hunched over a computer. Because even if you hop up and smile and shake their hand, that first few seconds of them seeing you hunched over, you look more like a losing athlete. And that's exactly what we don't want.
People must be so intimidated to be interviewed by you.
I hope not. I mean, I always say that I want to make it work just as much as you do, so hopefully not. But I do. I will say that I lead a life of radical honesty. It's something that I try, and so I have fewer friends but higher quality friends. So I always prefer quality over quantity.
Right. But I can just see somebody on the elevator ride up to your office, shoulders back, this, that.
Yes.
But, you know, that's how life is sometimes, you know? I mean,
I know. It's great. I love it. Like, that's exactly what I want them to think before coming up to an interview.
And I feel like that's how you prep anybody for any situation, because I have daughters. I tell them that's how you hit a home run. You're prepared, you're calm, you know, and you just come across as open and confident.
Yes, right.
You know?
Yes, I totally agree.
So I know we got to wrap up soon, but tell me about your book, Captivate, The Science of Succeeding with People.
Yeah, so this is the textbook that I wish I had growing up on people. I tried to build a framework around people just like you would read a chemistry book or a history book.
Mm-hmm.
So I talk about conversations, first impressions, and again, it's broken up as the first 5 minutes, the first 5 hours, and the first 5 days. And so if you interact with people ever, I would highly recommend it. And it's my personal playbook. A lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into it. Not a lot of blood, but definitely a lot of sweat and tears.
I would hope.
No. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just thrilled that it's finally out there. It's the book I've been working on my whole life.
Fantastic. And where can people find out more about you?
Yes, scienceofpeople.com. That's our website. We have a video trailer for the book. We have you can play in our lab and take a bunch of human behavior research experiments. That's where all of our articles are, and we have some really, really fun videos as well there.
And I love, by the way, what you did. You talked about the power of the TED Talks, the speakers,
yes.
In the first 7 seconds, the impression.
Yes. If you go to scienceofpeople.com/TED, you can actually read. We analyzed thousands of hours of TED Talks looking for patterns, and we found 5. So it's a really fun one. If you like TED Talks, you'll never watch a TED Talk the same way again.
Oh, I love them. I love them. Well, I want to thank you so much. I know we have to wrap up, and it's been great having you on. And so maybe we'll have you back on again because there's so much to talk about.
Oh, gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I very much appreciate it.
You're so welcome. If you missed any part of this segment with Vanessa Van Edwards, it will be up on the show blog, getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. And if you want to find out about being a guest, you can email me at Janeane, J-A-N-E-A-N-E, @kuci.org.